Hi, my name is Kira Conville. Welcome to Two Spots Cafe Bariva Swords, and you're listening to The Sod Show.
You are the unofficial coffee suppliers to The Sod Show, Kira.
Yeah, we are. The best coffee suppliers in Dublin.
In Ireland.
In Ireland, sorry. And I'm the best barista in the world as well.
After your brother Sean, that is.
Yeah, I take after him.
Excellent. Thank you, Kira. Pleasure as always.
Thanks, Peter.
103.2 Dublin City FM. Friday, 3 p.m. Gardeners all over the world listening to The Sod Show with Peter Donegan.
You would have heard me talk last week with Eugene Higgins. We're back at Two Spots Cafe in Bariva Swords because it's inside and it's dry and it's a Friday afternoon and it's almost a weekend. If you're listening to this in the future, happy Monday, Wednesday, Friday, Valentine's Day, Christmas. I hope you had a good Halloween. Eugene Higgins, garden correspondent with the Irish Daily Mail. Is that the correct intro, Eugene?
Yeah, actually, Irish Mail and Sunday, Peter, to be precise, but you got the general gist, and whoever else will have me, I'll be corresponding for.
We were talking last week briefly, we kind of skipped very, very, very quickly from your early days of me and you knocking around together, you might say. You had a garden centre, I was coming out of college, how I was much younger and better looking than you, or vice versa, and also... We dabbled a little bit into the, you might say, the childhood of Eugene Higgins. I say a slight bit. To bring it all the way back to Peter growing plants under his bed, do you remember the first thing you ever grew as a child?
You see, this is an interesting one, Peter, because I didn't grow plants in singular. I was dispatched from as soon as I could walk or do anything to do something constructive. That would include planting chrysanthemums en masse to be produced into chrysanthemum blooms, picking tomatoes, moving primulas, disbudding chrysanthemums. Now, if anyone knows what that is, and it's relentless. But as a child, you might find a couple hours you'd be dedicated with a couple of other kids, brothers and sisters and other kids, to do it, and you'd learn. So for me, everything was grown en masse. The one area that didn't interest me, I realised when I'm older, and I'm still the same, there was a lot of propagating going on, as in cuttings, seeds, and I just never had the interest in it. And the reason for that is that I'm a bit impatient, and I just don't have that methodical brain that allows people to put the seed in, plant it in the compost, allow the right moisture in, put the glass lid on top, let the right amount of light in, wait for it to grow. Yes, there's a lovely, warm feeling when things grow, but I wanted to see them when they were ready to go. So lots of planting. It's funny, when you've asked me a question, I've never thought about that before. The singular one plant under my bed or on the windowsill, no, they were all outside our door, and they were there en masse, and that's how it was for me.
But you were kind of born, you might say, into an industry where I was, I guess, at 5-6 years of age, I was more like the hobby, I won't say hobby gardeners, but people who have, like, let's say you're an accountant for a living, but you enjoy gardening at the weekend and you have a little glass house. I was doing that maybe when I was 6 years of age. You were growing for the garden centre industry when you were 6 years of age. Is that a fair description?
Growing for what was a plant nursery that was becoming a garden centre. So we were growing what was going out the door. So whether it was tomatoes or lettuce, chrysanthemums, irises, gerberas, and many others that I can't remember off the top of my head. I remember irises now specifically. These were grown and they went out the door either. And then my father got the idea of bringing people to cut their own flowers, which I think had been done in a couple of other nurseries at the time. So you could then cut your own, or someone would cut them for you. You go home with fresh flowers. The interesting thing about this, Peter, is I've come to realise, is that my grandfather had set up plant nursery in 1940. There was a high demand in old Ireland that was still alive then for a kind of a Downton Abbey bunch of chrysanthemums that weren't cheap, they were expensive. I think by modern standards, I calculate they're about €20 to €25 for a dozen of these majestic blooms. They would go to Liverpool, they would go to Belfast, they would go to, you know, that old English market. It still exists in England to a certain extent. Before the Dutch decided to subsidise their gas and grow things considerably cheaper. So it was a different experience at that time. That's coming. There are people beginning to do that again, a bit like the GIY, grow your own flowers, go to the place, see them there. So it's cyclical. It evolves, it comes back. But the market was so different and all those flowers went out the door, or we boxed them up and drove up to Larne as a child. I was people were surprised when I did UTV's Glorious Gardens that I knew Larne's. How do you know Larne so well? Oh, I spent my childhood here, you know. Leave at 5 a.m., get there at whatever, 8 a.m., unload and send them across to the clients. But that died out, and then we deviated into the retail market. That kind of got my interest then.
You know, the cyclical, you know, the DIY, this isn't be disingenuous to the good people of Grow It Yourself Ireland, but as regards Grow Your Own, to be more specific, do you think it has gone past its peak? Do you think it's on the downward trend? Do you think that people trialed the raised beds? I mean to go past the cobblock epidemic to the decking, and then it actually became a point where I was being asked to take up decks and build raised vegetable beds out of them, and I was kind of going like, holy crap, this is literally sign of the times. Do you think that's kind of peaked? Do you think people wanted to do the Good Life television program and they went, oh shit, I have to go to work, I don't have time for an allotment, but how much? Hold on a second. Because there was actually, a point where you could buy 5 kg of potatoes washed for $2.99 and a 1 litre pot of potato seed, never mind the compost, was £3.50, €3.50, if you want to call it that. Do you think it's gone past it? What has happened there?
Okay, I think, to coin a ridiculous phrase, I think we've weeded out the people who really weren't able and didn't have sufficient interest but thought it was a trendy thing to do. So the slightly trendy element has gone out of it. I think a lot more people want to grow their own things at home, and I think that it's continuing, and I think that it actually is growing. Interestingly, I took a visit during the year to Mr. Middleton's wholesale department, which is in Glasnevin, and they told me they had 40,000 plus clients on mail order in Ireland, where they send them out seeds and all the various items that they need to undertake that element of gardening. So it's a little bit quieter, it's maybe not as high profile on the media, and maybe people are busy, but I do think it's there. And I mean, I don't know how you felt about this, Peter, but allotments when I was a child growing up were something that went on somewhere in the inner city and in England. I knew nobody really who had an allotment. Now it's a topic of conversation, and I think the people now who still have the allotments are genuinely interested and are getting a great joy out of growing their own plants, flowers, vegetable, what they can eat. So that's my vision of how, or my understanding of how it's teased out over the last few years.
Well, my understanding of allotments was that after the World Wars, in the UK in particular, they became a thing. And when the Irish, who without in any way referencing politics, this is show is one that does not do that. But if you know the War Memorial Gardens in Island Bridge, you'll know that nearby there were allotments in Inchicore that were given to the guys who returned home after fighting abroad. And they were, I won't say a sign of being a little bit broke, but the whole thing was to encourage you to provide for your own food because you may not have had the money to do so. And that's kind of where it a little bit started. The fact that it became, and all of the books became, Grow Your Own and Save Yourself Money, or and it was that big tagline that kind of came with it, and then people kind of quickly realized, well, hold on a second, you can't. And so maybe with the economic upturn, if it's, and that's a positive to use that word again, it seems to be that cyclical thing of getting your garden done as versus going to the garden center or trying to badly DIY. Homer Simpson's shelf comes to mind, and doing it yourself and it looking a bit crap, and then you get the pro in and it looks genius and you walk out the door and you've got that new thing, which is always a good thing, especially for somebody like myself and yourself. So just to clarify, not knocking anybody, just two guys having a chat. If you disagree with this, that's absolutely fine. Welcome. You're more than welcome to come on air. We've had everybody literally on the show, from homeopathic gardeners, who I would totally not be a fan of, but I think and believe we've given that we gave a good airing of that interview, or somebody's side. It's all horticulture, folks. It's all great outdoors, and it is all great. At Sod Show on Twitter, if you want to give us a little bit of feedback on any of this, as a by the way, and you're more than welcome to come on. But it has kind of come out maybe the far side of that. I know the UK, the seed wholesalers over there were saying that vegetable seeds were, I think it was last year, the year before, they released a press thing saying it was sales of vegetable seeds were on the decline, while sales of, you might call it, flowering, as in garden plant type seeds, were on the increase, which is the first time, I think, since probably about 2011.
All that makes sense, Peter. Just let's go back a little bit from what you said there, if you don't mind. In relation to allotments, I think you described it very well, Second World War, post-Second World War. And I felt, looking back on it, that allotments, we came a bit nouveau riche over a period of time. You know, Ireland got its independence. We did our own thing. I think if you were growing stuff, it was deemed to be a little bit as if you were poor. That's unfortunate, but that has changed. Allotments, you know, interestingly, what I'm trying to tell you now is I saw a documentary which came to mind when you were saying it on just after the Second World War in Britain, and Winston Churchill commissioned a photograph of on the entire city of London, and they put them on a grid, and they had a plan to completely change London after the war, which didn't happen. Looking at the old photographs, they discovered that London was covered in allotments. Parks were full of vegetables. Something wasn't really written down, and it wasn't recorded. And I believe the same, you know, St. Anne's, Phoenix Park, there was an awful lot of self-sufficiency going on. I know Cuba has a better climate, but look what they do in terms of growing their own self-sufficiency. So flower sales going up, vegetable seeds going down. Yeah, it peaked a few years ago. It'll turn around again in a few years. I'm very happy that the flower sales, like the British Classic Garden, is back in vogue. I think the winter of 2010 put to sleep the ambitions people like me had of growing bits of Australia and bits of South Africa in my garden. I've very much become a believer in, not completely native, but plants that will do well, that will grow well in our environment, are the ones that we need to grow. So, you know, having things like verbenas and having a classic country garden, British-style flowering plants that will give you relentless colour, rudbeckias, coreopsis, there's tons of them, wallflowers. I'm delighted to hear that that's on the upturn.
Okay, here's the bit where you get to pay yourself a few compliments. How good of a landscape gardener are you? Do you call yourself a landscape gardener? Do you call yourself a horticulturist? Do you call yourself a garden designer? What's a media bit aside?
Well, you have to be careful what you call yourself because, you know, the word landscape architect was thrown around a few years ago, and I'm obviously not that. So I am a landscape designer, simple as that. For me, when people ask me who or what I am, or I've worked in media and they may draw analogies with other well-known landscape designers, the first thing I say to them is that my strength is teamwork. For me, getting out to design a garden is about looking for the strengths of other people and working as a team. So I like to think I have good management skills, I've got good vision, I've definitely got very specific ideas. But if I'm doing something ambitious, I want to involve people that I can work with, that I believe do good work, and that I can bring all that together to create a garden that the client wants, and at the same time annoying them a bit by trying to educate them and saying, look, perhaps we should do this. I can annoy customers a little bit in a nice kind of way, saying, well, look, these are all the points you have to consider, because I am so tired of hearing, you know, when you ask them, well, why is the deck in the shady area? Well, no one ever asked me. Why is the patio, you know, Indian sandstone where algae grows in the shade? Because no one ever asked me. So we like to pose all of those questions. So am I a good landscaper? I deliver what I believe is an excellent product for my clients. And I think that stands up in time. But it's not me and my wonderful vision. It's me and a team. Now, that team is defined completely differently nowadays, where we had a number of employees in Colour Green's books. Now we bring people in to work with us and subcontract them as a team. So, for example, I would know maybe the agronomist, perhaps I'd know the arborist. Perhaps I need to bring in a decker. They work for themselves separately and work for me on board when we're doing the garden. So that's kind of where I see myself.
Are you a member of any horticultural trades association, Eugene?
No, because I know myself, I've become to realise how I'm just not good in groups of people. I haven't got the tolerance to listen to opinions that I'm not interested in. So, like a debate or an argument is something eventually I'm not interested. This is what I think. I'm very interested to hear your point, but to sit down and have a wholesale argument over something I'm not that interested in or prepared to put my time to, going to meetings and listening to, unfortunately, sometimes, I mean, they probably think the same of me, and I accept that. This is what the world is made up of, different opinions. But I am not affiliated, or I'm not a member. I recognise the fact that I'm just too much of a maverick, and I will upset people with my opinions and going to relentless meetings. And I respect they have their opinion, I have mine. They probably think I'm equally as annoying as I might think of them. The thing is, it's not the people individually, it's collectively as a group. But I just prefer to do my own thing. In terms of people like the National Trust, who do such brilliant work in the UK, I get to see their work when I do stuff for the Irish Mail or News Talk or any of the other groups. But I've often considered, but just never got around to ticking that box.
Can't disagree with Eugene. Used to be a member of associations and used to be friends of associations. Number one, it's an overhead. Number two, too many meetings. Number three, a lot of people talking about the same things. And number four, if you're unsure of what I'm saying, then I'll simply put it to you this way. Go and look at when the association first started and then check the membership numbers. So over a 30-year period, if your numbers are less than 100 or 120, maybe you're not doing the right thing and maybe things need to change. And again, it's all about... And the reason why I grew plants under my bed, the reason why I got into the trade that I did, the education that I took, and also in business for the last 15 years is not, and I double underline this, and the same goes for the Sideshow, it's not to win shiny things. It's not to win awards, it's not to win those certificates. It's because I love what I do for a living, and there is no trade association that's going to help me while it's minus 18 Celsius on Christmas Day and we have record rainfall levels. Equally, there's no trade association going to make my garden more creative or prettier or homely or more beautiful or make you smile more than the next one. There's none that is going to do that. What does the future hold for Eugene Higgins?
The future? Well, I think I touched on that slightly earlier in that garden management, I think we discussed that already. So garden management, seeing the economy picking up, people coming to ask me to design their garden, plant their garden, fine-tune their garden. We also, as I say, I'm looking at maybe outside Ireland, working on a project that might take us outside Ireland that would showcase what we do in Ireland in terms of the high standard of gardening that does exist. I mean, I don't want to sound negative all the time about everything. You know, showcase the really good people abroad, maybe a little bit more, and setting up maybe a potential. I've always been interested in the garden tour thing, an excuse to go to other gardens in other countries, enjoy with other people, and garden tours. It strikes me there's quite a number of people of a certain age that are probably, you know, retired who would like to go somewhere that's sunny, see a nice garden, drink a glass of wine. That's potential. And in terms of media, the thing about Ireland is there's always things floating around, and at the least unexpected moment someone turns up with an idea. You know, I worked with Sheila Shoig on her show for 2 years. There's always someone coming down the tracks who you'll be asked to talk about gardening. And once I get in the door, I usually find that I stay for a while, bore them, but enjoy the interaction, that one. So, and maybe broaden the writing a bit. I don't feel the desire to write a book because I haven't... I feel I've plenty to say, but is it worthy on paper? Perhaps not. But at some time, I'd like to find... Maybe Gardenside Manners is a title that occurs to me. We all need some Gardenside Manners, Peter. And that might be worth a title and a book down the road. That would be very dictatorial, though. My rules, my way.
The last time we were out for a drink again, we noted on it earlier, but we were in the Mansion House. It was with thanks to Bord B, I should add. We were there with the Ireland's only horticultural trade magazine. Joseph Blair was in our company. How is it a good sign? We for those of you who aren't aware, by the way, Ireland had no trade magazine for about 6 years, I think 7 years maybe approximately, and we finally have one back. It's a bi-monthly issue. If you search Sideshow or just search Horticulture Connected is the magazine, you'll find it at Sideshow on Twitter if you're stuck. It's good to have that back. Bord B are doing good work. We have a trade magazine. We have an Irish garden radio show. It's hosted by the best looking horticulturist in the country, even better looking than you, and that is saying a lot. Is the future bright for the horticultural industry in Ireland?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we've touched on this in terms of the state of the economy previously. We've touched it in terms of what people and how they're spending in garden. We've touched on it and how the media perhaps is not tapping into this enough. You know, gardening articles are at the back of the newspapers. Gardening features, like there is a show, in a show on RT Radio 1. I've spoken to them before about perhaps doing something better. But the future is always bright because the future is out there and we can only improve. Sometimes we disimprove, but overall, people like you and me, Peter, and you know Joseph Blair, I have to admire him, working basically online, getting the magazine into print form. He's the man. He's like the oracle of the horticulture industry. You just have to touch him and all that information just comes out. He knows everybody. He knows what's going on. Now, for maybe a lot of the listeners that you have, Peter, they're more interested in, you know, I was talking about lavenders and heathers and Pittosporum undulatum. But in terms of the trade people, listen, Joseph has his finger certainly on the pulse.
excellent stuff, Eugene Higgins. It has been a real genuine pleasure sitting in your company, as always. If people want to get in touch with you, Eugene, how do they go about that?
Well, they can get on the website, which is the usual www.eugenehiggins.ie. They'll find my email address there. I'm on Pinterest as well, or talk to you on the phone. If you're interested in doing something gardening, I'd be delighted to chat to you. I'm over-opinionated, but hey, you could either call that good or bad. We'll find out.
And who am I to talk about over-opinionated? As regards opinions, also I should note a big, huge, mahoose of thanks to the lovely team at Two Spots Coffee in Breva and Swords. They have been 110% fantastic, and the coffee is to die for. Brian, it is back to you in the studio. How good is your coffee there, Brian? How good is it? Yeah. Anyhow, okay, that's it. Take care. Have a great weekend. Slán, bye.
Dublin City FM coffee, Peter. It's not barista, no. A million thanks to Eugene for sharing his thoughts with us over the past 2 weeks. It's The Sod Show, 103.2 Dublin City FM, and a surprise for you. Not forewarned, but we have back on The Sod Show after a long break, but we're very glad to have her back. It's Jane Powers, and she's talking snowdrops. And with all that snow, it's about time we heard about it.
January and February, and sometimes even March, find me on my knees in the garden, worshipping at the throne of a particular plant. I'm in an ecstasy of wonder at the fair maids of February, the Candlemas bells, the drooping heads, the eve's tears, the naked maidens, not to mention the dingle bells, or Osquelga on Plurine Schnachte, the little flower of snow. Yes, as you've probably gathered by now, I'm talking about snowdrops. Or, as the English poet Thomas Tickell, who lived from 1685 to 1740, once called them, vegetable snow. Tickell lived for a time in Glasnevin, in the property that was to become the National Botanic Gardens. In his long, 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 very long poem, Kensington Gardens, a dead lover is resurrected as a snowdrop, which then multiplies exponentially until the ground is covered with vegetable snow. Snowdrops have inspired more poetry than almost any other flower, except perhaps the rose. Besides Tickell, I can summon up four snowdroppy poets: Samuel Taylor Coleridge, William Wordsworth, Alfred Lord Tennyson, and Erasmus Darwin. Who? Erasmus, grandfather of Charles. Grandpa Darwin was a physician, scientist, and, unusually for the end of the 18th century, an advocate of education for women. He believed that girls should be educated at schools with proper curriculums instead of at home with governesses. That's middle-class girls, of course. His snowdrop words go like so. Warm with sweet blushes, bright galantha glows, and prince with frolic step the melting snows. Galantha, as you know, or more correctly, galanthus, is the botanical name for the snowdrop. It comes from the Greek words gala and anthos, meaning milk and flower. Milk flower. I won't trouble you with the other romantic poets' snowdrop verses. You can find those on the web, or in many anthologies. But I would like to recommend to you the Irish poet Paula Meehan. In her book, Painting Rain, published in 2009, she has a beautifully poignant poem called Snowdrops. The imagery is vibrant and perfect. She describes the amber stamens deep in the flower as a hoard of gold like secret sunlight. And the inside of the innermost petals are three tiny striped green awnings that lend a kind of frantic, small-scale, festive air. Paula Meehan's poem is heart-wrenchingly moving as it talks of a dying friend, and I always feel a bit of a tremor when I read it. Snowdrops, in fact, have been traditionally associated with death, and in some folklores, bringing them into the house as cut flowers was terribly bad luck. It would lead, it was said, to someone in that household dying before long. This belief gave the snowdrop the name of death's flower. If you want to bring snowdrops indoors, and there is no better way to admire them, apparently it is quite all right to dig up a little clump and pop it into a pot. Bring them in just when the buds are about to burst, and they will open in the warmth of the house. Some snowdrops have a fragrance, so be sure to inspect with your nose as well as your eyes. When they have done flowering, carefully separate the bulbs and plant them again outdoors. There are many, many different kinds of snowdrops, which may come as a surprise to some. There are 20 species and hundreds, yes, hundreds, of named cultivars. The differences may seem tiny to you and me, but snowdrop fanciers, or galanthophiles, as they are known, have finely tuned sensibilities. The more you look, the more you see. Snowdrops can range from just a couple of inches tall to over a foot in height. Leaves can be shiny, matte, rolled, or pleated, and in every color, from moss green to blue-gray. And the flowers, oh, the flowers. It is the flowers that send poets and romantics into ecstasies. There are infinite combinations of green blips and blobs on the inner petals, and occasionally on the outer ones, and countless sizes and shapes. And the way that the fragile-looking white bells are held on their stems can also vary from variety to variety. Most of these cultivars are the result of plants crossing by happy accident, when a bee ferries pollen from one to another. Occasionally, interesting offspring are produced. Galanthophiles seize upon these unique bulbs and then build up their numbers over the years. These bulbs naturally produce identical babies, called offsets. So in the course of a decade, there might be enough to give away or sell to other galanthophiles. Galanthophilia is not for the impatient. Places to see snowdrop collections in Ireland include Burrtown House in Athy and Altamont in County Carlow. Both are running snowdrop events in February, which you can find by having a look on the web. Snowdrops have a long and rich history in Ireland and Britain. They are decidedly aristocratic bulbs. Or perhaps not. In England, as Richard Mabey reports in his Flora Britannica, first published in 1997, and a brilliant book on plant folklore, lines of snowdrops were sometimes used to mark the way to the outdoor privy. What a good idea! During the dark days and nights at the start of the year, you just follow the snowdrops to find your way to the loo.
It's great to hear her back on the Sod Show, Jane Powers and Snowdrops. More from Jane in the very near future. Our thanks to our sponsors, Green Sacks, compostable bags for home and garden. Check them out on the internet at vivagreen-greensacks.com. Our thanks, as always, to our producer, Peter Donegan, and to Katrina Redmond, who looks after our blogs. We're available on the internet at www.sodshow.com. On Twitter, we're at Sodshow. On Facebook, The Sodshow. And you can always email info@sodshow.com. We're back next Friday at 3 p.m. I'm Brian Green. Have a great week. Bye-bye.